Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. As you've come to expect, we Zoomed the day before. So Tuesday afternoon, we're Zooming, as I've been listening to the confirmation hearings of Amy Coney Barrett. And but we begin every single show, and we have since March, with the testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. He said to his papa, "It'll be okay." Well, it's not okay. Not okay for him, not okay for his twin brother. Frankly, not okay for any of us until perhaps change happens on the election. So now, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free, free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
I am really glad I got to meet Robert Hennelly. I don't know how it happened, but I'm really glad it did, Robert. So joining us right now from @StuckNation, Salon.com, InsiderNJ.com, and of course the chief leader is Bob. How are you?
Thanks for having me.
You sent me an article from MedPage today, and it was an article about herd immunity. And as I was looking at the article at MedPage today, I Googled herd immunity. And I saw this. Trump administration backs herd immunity to end COVID lockdown. Senior officials say White House supports controversial document that argues against lockdowns. So this is not about health. This is not about life. This is not even about the pandemic. It's all about the economy. And everyone is expendable on the way to a return to this economic vibrancy that only, I think, exists in Donald Trump's head. So let's talk about this concept of herd immunity. And I almost, you know what this feels like to me? You know how when you talk to people about climate change and they talk about the three people who are like climate scientists that don't believe in climate change, even though 1,000 scientists do believe in climate change? I feel like that's exactly what the Trump administration has done. They've cherry-picked all the public health people they could possibly find to support whatever it is that they're looking for in the way of a result.
Right. And I think also it depends. They do cherry pick in the narrative because this thing, we've been through this tribulation for several months now. I have consistently been reporting that what was driving the Trump administration strategy was herd immunity. I've never backed off of that. There have been individual people like Dr. Fauci who have pushed the what we consider like at least the basic kind of health protections, which would be social distancing, which would be mask wearing. But you just have to go back as a frame of reference to what happened with our friend Boris Johnson, the prime minister in England, who made a decision that they were going to ride this out initially. They were not going to shut down the economy. They thought they could soldier on. And this was something that got a lot of traction and was expressed throughout this whole time as a logical Malthusian thing, the concept that, you know, a certain number of people would have to perish as a down payment on prosperity. They've articulated this. It has proliferated the disease and spread the disease. And then they've restated it, taking out of context things from pediatric journals that talk about the importance of socialization for early primary and secondary education, all valid points. And then also avoided, I think successfully, really educating the public about the nature of this disease. I mean, for instance, when you talk about immunity, we now know there's been a confirmed case, thanks to MedPage, of people being reinfected and sometimes with the worst case of it. Yes. Number two, this idea of herd immunity discounts entirely the wear and tear on the first responders and the healthcare professionals that are on this Maginot Line that are getting eaten alive by this, to the point of 1,000 healthcare professionals at best count have died. Not to mention that we also find that it's been projected as this kind of simplistic thing, this binary reality of it either kills you and the odds are relatively small, will do that, or you survive. But there's a much messier third reality, which tens of thousands of people are living with, which is long-term infirmity related to it. Right. And so then on top of that, the cherry on the super spreader sundae is that we know that you can have long-term consequences and have been asymptomatic. That's right, sport fan. You could have not experienced it all, not even used a Kleenex, and showed up at your doctor several months later and find out that if you're like me, have other issues going on, that you now have coronary or respiratory issues. That just is not included in the corporate media's narrative.
So as you're talking about this, I happen to go to theconversation.com. Are we surprised, Ken? Where do I go? My favorite source. And there was an article that was posted yesterday. Why males may have a worse response to COVID-19. Be still, my heart. A boy disease? Do the boys know this? All those boys that are Let me just read you a couple of sentences. If you ask most women about how their male relatives, partners, and friends respond to being sick, they'll often tell you with an accompanying eye roll, "Oh, he's such a baby. He's an extra whiny." And they exaggerate. But there may be a biological explanation for this behavior. And they are now looking at COVID and they're describing it as the man flu. The man flu. So we're looking at an increased level of death with men. We're looking at the possibility that they're more receptive to getting COVID-19, that they're more complicated because of a result of COVID-19. I want this to be a billboard as they talk about herd immunity, because you were talking about the frontline workers. We're talking about the fact that they may be the long haulers that may actually have, you know, some kind of condition for a long time. I want to talk to all those boys out there and say, COVID likes you.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's as a matter of fact, one of the things that should be informing the debate around the Supreme Court nominee, and I'm glad to see the Democrats in the Senate Judiciary Committee making the stand, is talking about the Affordable Care Act and how extraordinarily relevant it is right now. It's important. The Commonwealth Fund had a very important study that came out that showed that even at a 45,000 daily infection rate, which would be a good day compared to some of the numbers we've seen, we are creating 20,000 non-elderly individuals who will have pre-existing conditions a day. A day, my friends. I know that it may not fit into the Joe Biden narrative, but we're going to need universal health care as an emergency health requirement in a matter of months.
Right.
Because it's the only way to get ahead of this disease, because the disease, sorry, Governor Cuomo, is not in the hospital, it's in the community.
And can I just add, don't forget the long haulers, because in addition to the elders who will have pre-existing conditions, there are also these long haulers who they don't even know now if they're sick now, whether when and if they recover, they will have further really terrible, deadly repercussions down the road.
Well, and it's not like the long haulers.
And they won't have health care.
So right. You actually retweeted my tweet, Bob, and I want to comment on my tweet, because in a lot of ways it sort of synthesizes a lot of the conversation we're having right now. And I wrote, herd immunity, which is your point, will kill frontline workers with a significant lethal effect on people of color. Herd immunity will bankrupt the healthcare system, not just with the spike in illness at the moment of contracting the disease, but the long-term consequences of contracting COVID-19. So, but let's talk about COVID-19 because of the long-term pre-existing conditions. Right. You're talking about this bailout of healthcare. This is going to affect how we participate in the economy.
It already is.
I mean, if you are a long hauler, if you have some kind of a new illness, and we already know that so many people come into the economic system with some kind of a pre-existing condition, be it diabetes, be it heart disease, be it overweight, obesity. This is now compounding those situations by thousands, as you point out, every couple of months. And that is something that not only do we have to pay for because of the healthcare consequences, but it's going to impact how people are able to participate in the economy. Because if you have all these conditions, you're not as vibrant at your job.
Right.
You can't be. And we talked about the frontline workers. If they're the ones that are most susceptible, who is going to take care of our elderly? Who is going to drive our buses? Who is going to put out the fires? Because guess what? They are going to have a complicated health future. And that complicated health future means they're not available to all of us.
Right. One of the things that's going to happen in short order is that all the things that were considered so radical, I can't believe that Andrew Yang mentioned universal basic income. What a crackpad idea. All of that's going to become like very vanilla. It's going to become just like the way to keep everything working, basically. Okay. And give you a case in point would be what's happened with, we talk about the latest jobs numbers. You have to look at the fact that the huge number by the hundreds of thousands of women forced out of the workplace and out of the workforce. We have now had a catastrophic collapse, which it was already anemic, in something called workforce participation rate. Forget the unemployment number. That is a crazy kind of contorted thing that has all kinds of asterisks and footnotes. I keep my eye on the workforce participation rate because that tells you you're either looking for work, you have a job, or you've given up because your life is falling apart for other reasons. You're staying home with someone chronically ill, or as in the case of people that I know, you have a spouse who has a serious medical condition. They're surviving, but it's something like cancer that they're living with. And now your little job puts them at risk. So you're not working. So we've had this happen on such a massive micro split. And so we have like the Congress sorting, should we save airlines? Like they don't understand how badly deteriorated Main Street and MLK Boulevard are right now.
So Bob, why, this is the piece I don't get. I mean, I hear the Democrats talk a lot about what you're saying, but when I look at where the Republicans are in control, it is worse. It is worse now in the Rust Belt. It is worse now in places where, I mean, and how do they go home? How do they look at that unemployment line? How do they look at that food line? How do they look at those numbers and not process that this is not only not healthy economically and physically, but it is imploding the future? And I know that they feel this allegiance to Donald Trump, but they have survival thoughts as well. Do they care about how they survive, both as a politician, but as their state survives? I just don't get the disconnect. I get the cultish following of Donald Trump. I get that. But these boys and girls are not cults. They're not. They're a little more sophisticated than that. And I'm just trying to figure out what the hell they're processing, because I see what you see. You understand what the numbers say. We are seeing just an implosion of state and local government revenue streams. And I'm looking at all that, and I am trying to figure out what's their survival strategy.
Well, I think that this disassociative circumstance has been in play for several years. This just didn't happen when Donald Trump was elected. In fact, Donald Trump was elected because of it. He is symptomatic of this national lack of connecting the dots. It's important to understand that the patient, that would be the United States of America, was ailing for years before this, which I spoke on this show about. We know, for instance, if you're paying attention, that the bipartisan coalition of mediocrity that's been running the country ignored a decline in life expectancy, not just for 1 year, not just for 2 years, but 3 years, sports fans. And when's the last time that kind of poor performance happened? The last great pandemic. So you see there's a repeat pattern here. They let the fundamental public health circumstance of the American people deteriorate as their wealth grew exponentially. Not seeing the connection between the circumstance of the people that did the everyday chores and their future. And that disconnect is still happening. And it's still something where people figure, well, I can work from home. I don't, and you even hear it in the way that even our editorial friends that we're sympathetic with, like MSNBC, many of those shows are framed, not all of them, but some, as if you're the person that is at home, that has the luxury of working from home. You're the person that might buy the Mercedes-Benz that's advertised or go on a Viking cruise.
Right. Again, we Zoom on Tuesday. So I happened to catch Senator Lee talking. And Senator Lee, of course, is celebrating Amy Coney Barrett, right, in part because she is a pro-life conservative judge and will probably be a pro-life conservative justice, right, and with all the implications that it means. And as I'm listening to Lee, he's talking about the protection of life from the moment of conception to the end. And Amy is like, oh, yes. And I'm thinking, so let's talk COVID-19. Okay? No. I wanted to bring up herd immunity. I wanted someone to bring up herd immunity right after he said that. Because they're lying. They're lying. And nobody called them liars because they don't care. He said the responsibility of government, he made some line to this effect, is to protect and preserve life. And I'm putting my finger down my throat. Because if you understand exactly what we're talking about right now, coming out of this administration as an answer to the economy, not to preserving life, because life is expendable under herd immunity. That's exactly what we know. And we know that herd immunity may not even happen because we know about the guy who got it a second time and got it worse than he had it the first time. Right. So we know so little about this illness that every time we wait another month, we find another horrific story that we didn't know when we first started. We thought it was like an exaggerated flu. You know, initially. And now we're finding out that it's like this octopus and it has all these arms and all these tentacles that are creating even greater health havoc about things we never anticipated. And herd immunity is so dangerous, especially now when we're finding out that with each passing week, there's another complication from COVID-19 that has an incredible cost to society, families, and the economy.
Right. I would say that one of the things to keep an eye on here is, particularly among the folks that are espoused being pro-life, is just how hostile the Republican brand has been to young families that are trying to start out. I mean, one of the things, if you look at that demographers are concerned about, is the declining birth rate in the United States. Right. And this has to do with, and these are trends that were macro in nature, that were well-established prior to COVID, but now are going to become even more pronounced. How is it that we're not even accepting as a basic here that we're going to need to do a massive forbearance for student loans? I mean, that generation of young people that are, it's up to them to co-create the universe next, right? They're the ones we want to, like your daughter, and my daughters, we hope, we want to support them to have children. We want grandchildren. But the reality is we've created such a hostile environments economically, that it was even before COVID, it was difficult to accomplish. Right. So we're going to really have to think proactively how these things are connected by making a massive investment in public health. I mean, for instance, something as basic as, I don't know if you're aware of this, but in the United States, it's required to have a police department and a fire department. It's not required to have an EMS department. We have a patchwork of EMS across this country. In Texas, you can make $7.50 an hour and be an EMS professional and not have health care. So where's the imagination from Biden talking about a national EMS corps that should be established in all 50 states that has the basic thing that Clinton did with Safe Streets, where you fund where you're needed, basic head of household jobs to be the frontline public health person. That's the kind of investment, that's the kind of conversation we need to have.
You know, it's interesting you're talking about student debt. I remember writing an article for the Concord Monitor, and the title of the article was about student debt, and it was called The Anti-Dowry. Okay? And that's exactly what it was, okay? And right. Then you went through all the things that were going to be delayed because of this incredible, enormous debt. And it wasn't just living in your parents' basement, all right? Right. Now take the anti-dowry and all the complications we had before COVID, and now put in the pandemic year. The pandemic year where you can't find work, you are somewhat stuck in place, you are still accruing debt because they haven't given you this huge discount for law school or college or whatever. And yet you already know that the job opportunities that may change as a result of the pandemic aren't going to be available for you, or the jobs that you used to have while you were paying off your student debt weren't available this summer. There was no tourism this summer. Right. There was no restaurant gig this summer. There was no working at Disney this summer. Think about all the jobs that students have to go to in order to pay those student loans, and they don't exist. They don't, and we're not even sure when they're coming back, Bob.
Right.
So in a lot of ways, we are living in this la-la land, but it's young people that are sandwiched between, you know, really bad before and much worse now.
Right. And they also were, I mean, particularly in the 20s and early 30s, they were dealing with coming out of this low-grade recovery. And right. So those people that graduated into that after 2009, on average, were doing $10,000 less per year. And that can haunt you right into your middle years in terms of earning capability. That's why some states and cities passed laws where you don't have to declare what you were making. That's what we're going to see here now, where unless there's something done to even the playing field here, we're going to see, we have the same level of wealth inequality that we saw just before the Great Depression. And there's no sign of any consciousness by the national leadership that we're right on the precipice of going there again. And my concern is that there, it may not be, I know there's certain Democrats that think, well, the election will resolve it. My concern is this could drag on forever, that the cities and states and counties won't receive any money, that Biden could carry the popular vote and be stymied in a 2000 best case scenario where things drag on forever. And then you're into January, February, and at that point, we're already seeing the bond market where in New York City, New York State, the borrowing costs are going up. You'll have an implosion. And then that kind of thing is like the Titanic. It has a gravity of its own.
So one of the things I was reading about, you can't sell a piece of property right now in Vermont, Maine, New Hampshire. I mean, they are going like hotcakes, okay? Right. A lot of very affluent people, and they're upbidding. I mean, if you you put a price on it, and if you don't get $40,000 more, you're got a really bad realtor because everyone's moving here. But that's the affluent, all right? They can actually maintain a home here, but they're looking for a place that's not.
And they actually force working people out of their homes as a consequence. That's what happens.
And what's also happening is, but then you've got a group of people who can't pay the mortgage, okay? Because of what's happening of this economy, because of the pandemic, because of no bailout, because they haven't done a second bailout bill. And I am looking at who's buying those. And it isn't necessarily those sort of wealthy people from New York and Boston and Connecticut. It is billionaires. Because now what they're able to do is scoop up all these homes, and they're not going to sell them. They're going to rent them. Right. Because all those young people you were talking about, remember I talked about the anti-dowry?
Right.
Who is going to have money for a down payment? Nobody. Who's going to have the stability of an income over the course of time? Very few. So therefore, the idea of buying a house is now becoming so remote, and the billionaires love it because they've got a house they can rent to you.
And that actually is something that I've written a lot about, because this was in full swing as a response to the Great Recession. One of the things that happened when the Obama administration decided not to have a foreclosure moratorium, what they did was basically preserved and kept Wall Street whole. And the process did not save neighborhoods, MLK Boulevard or Main Street. And this is actually what gave Trump an opening, because we saw in Ohio, we saw in Wisconsin and Michigan that homeowners weren't made whole. Their property values dropped dramatically. And then often, the way that local governments made up for this, they raised the property taxes. So if you manage to keep paying the mortgage, then the aftershock of this tax hike knocked you out of the box. And we did have these predator hedge funds come in even before the pandemic and buy up this whole class of housing. And that's going to accelerate into a new form of American feudalism, which we're right in the middle of now.
That's your article. That's your next article for Salon. It's American feudalism. That's exactly right. We're all going to be serfs. We're all going to be living in a house that's owned by a bunch of billionaires that we never meet. And here's the interesting thing. You were talking about the property tax system. And I think in an interesting way, now you know why rich people really love property taxes. Because for them, it doesn't represent anything in the way of an effort for them to pay their property taxes, because their wealth isn't in their home. But if you are, you know, Joe middle class, the only wealth you have is your home.
Right.
So if you keep placing the burden on the property tax. And people's incomes are shrinking or declining in part because of the pandemic. Not only are they struggling to pay the mortgage, but what you know is the asset for you, if you're a rich guy, is that their property taxes are going to go up. And eventually, they're not going to be able to pay the combination of the property tax and the mortgage, and they're out of there. And the billionaire goes, not a problem. I'll buy it from you.
And that's why Donald Trump and Mitch McConnell have no problem with saying, you would like some municipal and county aid? Why not do that and then create a buying opportunity for the donor class?
Exactly. I mean, it's so funny. I've always fought the property tax because I said it had no relationship to ability
especially
to
pay. Especially your state, yeah. Right.
Right. But now I'm beginning to realize it aids and abets the wealthy, not because it's a low tax burden on them, it's because it's a high tax burden on me, and it's an opportunity for them to then say, oh, force her out of the house because she can't right. pay both, not a problem, I now can buy it cheaply, you know. Yeah. it's
she's zoomed from her car.
Yeah. Oh my god. So where does Biden go? How, if he, let's say he does win, and let's say that there isn't a civil war. We were going to be talking in the next half of the show about the white supremacists in the military. We're going to talk a little bit tomorrow about the militia in Michigan and the militia that's probably existing all over the country. But as I'm looking at that and that level of instability, not only do you want to have to deal with that instability because you need to somehow figure out how to tap it down, but the problem is, it's like that's happening in one area, and yet at the other area, you have all these people who have no small business to go back to anymore.
Right.
You have people who don't have the internet connection in order for them to work at home or teach their kids at home. Right. You have all these things hemorrhaging, and I'm just trying to figure out how does he triage what he does first, because I think we're bleeding everywhere.
Well, I think he asked one thing. We have to have a broad-based militant labor movement and progressive movement to hold him accountable. So we just don't count on him to fix it. Right. There was that whole assumption when President Obama in 2008 won and people looked at the United States like a new car they were going to take and get the oil changed. We'll leave it with them and they'll fix it. No, that won't do. So what has to happen is there has to be a very clear, broad-based agenda, which talks about making the investments that we have not made for the 20 to 30 years that led up to the pandemic. And there, it has to be broad-based. It has to include universal basic income. It has to include a way of, I mean, we're looking at the disability numbers are going to be crazy. So we have to really have the American economy reflect the reality of the people that are in the country. And that's going to require, like I said, this broad-based investment. Like, let's do something basic, an oldie but goodie. How about just have a school nurse in every school? What do you think?
Well, you know, Ken, I see your hand up, and I know we only have a minute left. But one of the things I keep thinking about is that, you know what you need to start doing? Because we're going to have all these people with these underlying health conditions, and a lot of people are going to have to right. take care of people, and we don't necessarily want to put them into a nursing home. You're going to have to start paying mom and grandma and your aunt to take care of them at home.
Yeah.
And you have to pay them. You can't just assume that I can be in the sandwich generation, yeah. that I can take care of my ailing spouse yeah. and my children who need to be educated without a paycheck. And you know what? Either pay it one way or you pay it another. Exactly. Pay me.
Exactly.
And in order to make this happen, Bob, I just want to say I agree with you completely that we need a strong and powerful burgeoning union movement that is progressively oriented. But also, there needs to be a shift in structural change, like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders said.
Right.
There needs to be a shift in power. It has to be more than just the Wall Street and the 1% and the big corporations, big donors to the politicians that are controlling everything. Because to ask the question, you know, how is Joe Biden going to handle this? Well, we got to keep pressure on Joe Biden after the election in order to make yeah. sure that he moves more towards where the unions and the progressives are and less towards where the bankers are.
And one of the answers, Bob, is we have to do some trust busting. We have to start breaking up some of those monopolies. Absolutely. If you want to have jobs and you want to have competition and you want to celebrate small business and you want to embrace the entrepreneur, then you've got to trust bust and you've got to break up those monopolies because they're putting a finger on this economy in a way that we don't even quite comprehend. We think that they're efficient. No, they're not.
No, they're not.
This is just
And actually, I think it has to do with diagnosing all the things that got us to this place, because all the points you were making about the concentration of wealth set the stage to make America as vulnerable to COVID as it is today.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We began this conversation, everyone, believe it or not, talking about the administration going back to something that they think they've always wanted, as you've said, and that is the Trump administration backs herd immunity to end COVID lockdown. Senior officials say White House supports controversial document that argues against lockdowns. What do you mean stay home? What do you mean you're vulnerable? Just get to work. Anyway, thank you, Bob Henley.
Thank you. Talk to you soon.
All right, we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Bob. Take care.
This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We'll be right back. Welcome back to part two of the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. A reminder that we are Zooming on Tuesday afternoon. So if something should happen Tuesday night, we'll be discussing it on Thursday. We mind theconversation.com a lot. And I've become not only seeing it as such a valuable resource, but it really gets me to sort of meet interesting people and interesting professors, but people who are actually able to bring their area of expertise to the table at a time that we need it most. And so we've been talking a lot about what happened in Michigan. And obviously we're very worried about, you know, Gretchen Whitmer and her family, because they were trying to, like, you know, capture her and make her a hostage. And we're learning about the Wolverine militia. And of course, I'm familiar with militia because New Hampshire has militia as well. And it turns out a number of states have. But in light of what happened in Michigan, I really thought it's important for us to see that this isn't just a militia story. That the story of white supremacists, that the story of this sort of, I don't even know what you would call it, but this unraveling of a stable society is happening in many locations, not just in the militia, in the police, including in our US military. And the article was entitled, "Americans Aren't Worried About White Nationalism in the Military Because They Don't Know It's There." Ay, ay, ay. Jennifer Spindle is an assistant professor of political science at the University of New Hampshire. We found out that she was at Dartmouth. We found out that she was at the University of Minnesota. We found out that she was at Oklahoma. But how did you fall into this arena as, like, your area of expertise? What was the invitation in? Was it from your family? What was the curiosity that said, I need to explore this and start connecting the dots, not only for my students, but it turns out now for the public at large, because we're going to be coming back to you, I'm afraid, more often than not.
Sure. Well, thank you so much for inviting me to be on the show with you. My interest in this topic stems from a broader interest in civil-military relations. So in the United States, how civilian leaders relate to and exercise control over the military, how they decide where and when to use force. And what I noticed, and my co-authors on the piece noticed, was that under President Trump is a sort of acceleration of a trend we've seen over the past few decades, a real privileging of people with military experience in civilian political office. And so we saw President Trump picking as his advisors, as the leaders of cabinet departments, people who had very recent military service, like the phrase President Trump and his generals. And so as we saw the concurrent unraveling of political society in the United States, was really interested of the role the military was playing in this process. The military in general is a very trusted institution in the United States. It's one of the last institutions that a majority of people actually trust. And Americans are generally deferential to those in the military. So I was really interested in what military members thought and saw about white nationalism and how that compared to what the general public was thinking.
So let me ask this interesting question. We now have a voluntary military. And my understanding was that one of the values of the US military was the first place where real integration happened. It is a place where if you are African American, you could really move up the ladder and achieve, you know, some military greatness. You know, it was not like corporate America, it was very different. And that as a result of this voluntary military, we also saw it as a place of opportunity. So if you weren't figuring out, how do I pay for college? How do I get a job? How do I develop a skill set? For a lot of people, you know, if you couldn't play basketball, maybe you joined the military, okay? And so when I read your article about this white supremacist in the military, I'm trying to figure out, so like, what was their invitation in? And knowing that it's a place where it's a place of opportunity for people of color, I'm trying to figure out, how do they thrive there? How do they survive there? And how do they like it when the guy in the bunk next to them is a black guy?
That's a great question. And I think, you know, this narrative that we have about the US military as a place of integration and opportunity is in many ways true. Okay. And so to that, I would say yes, and the and is that there's this story of segregation that is baked in to the US military, and that continues today. Just a few days ago, I was actually reading a document made by the Army War College in 1925, talking about the performance of African American soldiers in World War I. And this document basically said that African Americans were not going to be allowed into combat positions, but that they could be cooks or transportation specialists. And that was official US policy. The ranks were segregated through World War II. Right? That's very recent history. You know, another thing that we see even after the ranks have been integrated is the legacy of white supremacy in many ways. So you have military bases that are named after white supremacists. Fort Benning, where the Army's infantry school is housed, was named after a Southern secessionist, a man who was never part of the US Army, but who fought against it. So there are still these signifiers, these legacies, and these symbols of white supremacy in the armed forces today.
So one of the things I was reading as I was looking at your article, I went back to what happened in Michigan, and they arrested 13 people, three of which had a military connection. Two were Marines, and another guy, I believe, was an instructor at one of the Fort Jackson or Fort, whatever the fort was. And that's 3 out of 13. So if I look at your article and you talk about the percentage of folks that have this sense of white supremacists in the military, that number, just as we saw being arrested in Michigan, paralleled the number that you evidence in your article. It is about 20 or 30% of the folks in the military will tell you that they have some kind of experience with white supremacists. So I am looking at that connection from what you pointed out in your article, and then the actual number of folks that were arrested with this military connection. And I'm thinking, is the attraction—
Sorry, I didn't quite catch that.
Oh, sorry.
Could you please repeat it?
That's my computer. So what I'm hearing from you is that, are they going into the military not because of military service in air quotes, but because it's a way for them to be trained in the use of weaponry, the way to be trained in order to understand how to attack the enemy? And the enemy isn't someone that they're necessarily thinking about in Afghanistan or Pakistan or whatever, that they want to take those tools and those skill sets and bring them back home.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's a really important observation. And, you know, most people who join the military aren't doing it to then go join a white supremacist group. But for those who have that interest or maybe that predisposition, military training is seen as an attractive place to learn skills like firearms training or bomb making, to learn discipline and small unit command. And so those skills are then brought over to these militias, who then use them for acts of violence. You know, I think it's worth noting that the October 2020 Homeland Security Threat Assessment noted that violence from white supremacist groups is going to remain the most persistent and lethal threat in the United States in the coming year. The Department of Homeland Security also noted that 2019 was the most lethal year for domestic violent extremism since the Oklahoma City bombings, right? And that bomber had military training as well. So while this is something that we're seeing increasing in size, it's not necessarily new.
So what do we do? How do you thin the ranks? Do you give them some kind of a psychological test? Do you get rid of the idea of the voluntary military and then basically say we all have to join some kind of universal service? Therefore, you thin out the ranks and the reason for showing up may be different. I am just trying to figure out, How do you deal with it? Because we have this sense that it's not just in the United States military, but that now it has also infiltrated the police. So we always know that there's this idea of, you know, the police, are, that some police are racist and they have this tendency to sort of, you know, look at people by color as opposed to whether they've actually committed some kind of a crime. But when I'm reading the story about the military and I'm reading about what their skill set is, that's the same skill set you'd see in the police. That's the same skill set that you would see in the militia. And I'm just trying to figure out if this is the web we are weaving, how do you unweave it?
Right. And so there are ways to start doing that. Unfortunately, one of the things that happened in very recent history was that the phrase white nationalist was removed from the National Defense Authorization Act. And basically what that meant is anyone who is interested in joining the military undergoes a background check. That background check makes sure that they're not going to be susceptible to foreign bribery, that they're not linked to so-called enemies of the United States. And in previous years, recruits had been screened or were supposed to be screened for ties to white nationalist or white supremacist groups. That phrase was removed in 2019. And so being a member or potentially associated with those groups was no longer a disqualifier. Now the Senate and the House have said that they're both interested in putting that phrase back in and screening people for ties to white supremacy and neo-Nazi activity. But the House and Senate have also said that that's not likely to happen before the election. So action on that would be a great first step.
So you said it happened in 2019. Did it happen legislatively? Did it happen by executive order? Did it happen because one of my generals, as in Donald Trump's general, how the hell did this happen? I mean, we're looking at the Black Lives Matter movement. We're looking at all the things that are happening at the backdrop, and we're looking at what happened at Charlottesville, and you're looking at all this, and now you're telling me in 2019, they removed this? I'm trying to figure out, you know, who needs a lobotomy here? Because this was the worst time to have taken something like that out. So whose fingerprints, Jennifer, on it? I want to know who owns this.
So this is the result of increasing polarization in partisan politics. It's the continuation of a process started by President Trump when he defunded countering violent extremism efforts focused on the United States. So under President Obama, there was an effort to actually investigate and look at the growth of violent white nationalist groups in the U.S. President Trump ended that program. And then under the Senate, the National Defense Authorization Act, which is a big funding bill for the military, would not have been passed unless that phrase white nationalist was removed.
But who put it in? I want the name of the senator. I want the name of the House member. I want the name of the person within the, I want to identify the person. Things don't show up in a bill. And they don't get not passed without it in there unless someone owns it. Is this a Mitch McConnell thing? Is this, I'm just trying to figure out, because I think these connections and these connecting the dots have to be made known to people. The whole point of your article, again, I'm going to read the title. Americans aren't worried about white nationalism in the military because they don't know it's there. Well, in 2019, I did not know that they put that into that reauthorization. I want to know who is responsible, or is it the kind of thing where no one is owning it, but everyone is demanding it?
It's the kind of thing where no one is owning it. So under the House Armed Services Committee was willing to have that provision included, and it got stripped in the Senate, right, which is under Republican control and Republican leadership. Given the rise in white nationalism and visible white nationalism in the U.S., you know, both branches of Congress have said they're interested in putting it back. But again, we really won't know until that bill is finalized and comes out.
So as tomorrow, we're going to be talking about the, in specific, the militia in Michigan. But as you pointed out to me, it turned out that it wasn't just the governor of Michigan that they were ready to sort of, you know, make a hostage. They were also looking at the governor of Virginia. So we are now looking at basically anyone with a Democratic name next to them is now incredibly vulnerable. Anybody who's a high profile person is incredibly vulnerable. Anyone who asks a question like I just asked of you, who the hell's fingerprints are on this in 2019? And you can't give me an answer. It is incredibly chilling, because I'm just trying to figure out, if you are even a Republican governor, do you want to turn the other cheek and not acknowledge what's happening because there are militias in your state as well? Or how do you, as a governor protect the institutions of government from people like this? Because it seems like, you know, under Donald Trump, they've proliferated. But in the end, that level of instability isn't good for a Republican governor or a Democratic governor.
Exactly. And I think, you know, it's really important to note that both Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer and Virginia Governor Ralph Northam were the target of attacks by President Trump, who had tweeted "Liberate Michigan and liberate Virginia" in response to those governors trying to mitigate the spread of the coronavirus pandemic. And now we've learned that both governors were the target of militia abduction schemes. So I think you raise a really important point about institutions, and that's why this link to the military is so important in my view, that the military, again, is this really trusted organization and this trusted institution. And so if the American public sees the military tolerating or tacitly condoning white supremacists in their ranks, well, why should anyone else stand up to them? Right? The military is this trusted and respected institution.
So I hear what you say, that was put into the 2019, whatever, the reauthorization bill, that the bill with all the bells and whistles and money. Because it's not there, does that mean that the generals can't still pursue it? Like, do I need it in a bill that says I don't have to necessarily look at this, but you could say, well, that's nice, but I'm still gonna look at this because the safety and the stability of the military is my job. And safety and stability is not going to be promoted if 20 or 30% of them are white supremacists. It's not good for the kind of control I need to have within the military institution. It's not good for the country. And I understand you removed it, but is that an obligation then on the United States military not to pursue and ask those questions?
So it means that belonging to or having potential affiliations with a white supremacist group is not an automatic disqualifier. It doesn't mean that those people can't be disqualified for other reasons. And I think there's reason to believe that military leadership is very concerned about this. So not only are troops in general concerned, the latest 2020 Military Times poll said that 47.6% of active duty and veteran respondents who took this poll believe that white nationalism was a significant threat to national security. And that's higher than the number who thought North Korea was a significant threat.
Oh,
I think there's growing recognition of this, which I think is leading military leaders to try to tackle this, because these stark divisions actually make it hard for there to be cohesion in the ranks and for the military to be effective.
Yeah, Ken, you want to weigh in?
Yeah, can I just ask you to look at the flip side or comment on the flip side? You're talking about militia people who are embedded in the military. And I want to ask you about the kind of intertwining of military people out with the militia, the Proud Boys. For instance, in Portland, when people, maybe you wouldn't consider them actually military because they're not controlled by the Defense Department, but all of these Border Patrol, BORTAC, and ICE officers who are law enforcement officers and carry guns and dress just like, you know, they're in the Marines, were out there snatching people off the streets with no reason, with no identification on themselves, saying that they were agents of the federal government. In fact, for all the folks on the street knew, the protesters, for all they knew, these actually were just Proud Boys. And then the other piece that I wanted to throw in there with that is, I think you probably know that ICE, the deportation agency, reached out to what they were trying to create called citizens academies, where they would recruit people probably from the same militia groups to come and learn from them how to use weapons and how we go about our business enforcing deportation laws and everything, immigration laws. So this intertwining of the militia on the streets and the military, whether it's the militia coming into the military or the military going out into the militia in the streets, what do you think of that?
Yeah.
Where's that going?
So that's a great question. One of the hardest things about studying this topic is it's really hard to get a count or a sense of how widespread white supremacy is in the military, in the police, or in these other organizations, because people usually aren't announcing their membership in these groups. And so what we can do is look for examples when this has come to light. So as you mentioned in the case of ICE, or we know that a private security firm in Minnesota was trying to recruit former special operations people to so-called guard polling sites. They said that they were trying to prevent left-wing activists from disrupting the election, but that's illegal. That is voter intimidation, right? Nonetheless, it shows that there are very frequent examples of organizations that are not the military, whether they're private, whether they're other governmental organizations, recruiting or incentivizing this type of behavior.
So I'm looking at another article at theconversation.com, and I just want to read this. According to most militias, the Second Amendment, they say, authorizes their activity and likewise makes them free of legal regulation by the state. In truth, the Second Amendment does nothing to authorize private armed militias. Private armed militias are explicitly illegal in every state. In every state. So now, what does being illegal mean and the Wolverines? Okay, I'm just trying to, what does illegal mean and the White Mountain Militia? What does, so to say that they are illegal in every state seems to be a toothless statement that nobody has ever enforced. They clearly have not explained it to the militia because they think it's a Second Amendment right. And it turns out it's not. I read that and I was like, blow me away with a feather. I had no idea, just the way that most people have no idea about how many white supremacists are in the military. When do we get educated on this? When does someone tell me that what they're doing is not only wrong, it is freaking illegal?
Well, and if it's illegal, when does some officer of the law enforce that?
Like an attorney general.
Yeah, like stop. Well,
right. Well, they'll enforce it if the group of people organizing with guns is not white, right? And that's what we've seen about enforcement of gun rights and the Second Amendment in America is this very different treatment based on the racial identity of who's holding the gun. So if you remember in Michigan, again, protests about opening up the Senate, right? There were men in quasi-military gear with assault rifles standing in the Michigan Senate, in the Michigan State House. If those people had not been white, I find it very hard to believe that there would not have been a police response or some sort.
Oh, they'd have been dead. They'd have been shot dead.
Right. And so we see repeated examples of African-American men being prosecuted and even killed for perceived weapons possession, right? And it's quite a different story for white people holding guns.
So I want to go back. I haven't even thought about this for such a long time. But during the Iraq War, what we realized is that there was the US military, but then there were a lot of these like private military operations. In fact, I can't remember his name now, but the guy that was sort of in charge of taking care of Baghdad, he was not protected by the US military. He was protected by basically this sort of private, you know, group of folks who, you know, created the illusion of being the military, were on some kind of a payroll, wore a uniform, but they were not part of the US military. And I remember a lot of folks who were actually serving resenting the fact that they were there. So we saw that in the Iraq War, and you saw this tension between, you know, the boys that were playing military and the boys that were really military. And there was this tension there. And I feel like that was never resolved back then. And to some extent, we're sort of getting the blowback from having never addressed it during the Iraq War.
Right. And so one of the trends that we've seen since 2001 and the global war on terror has been an increased reliance of the US government on private military corporations that are sent to various places overseas to accomplish a wide range of goals that the US government has set for them. And as the war on terror has expanded and dragged on, the use of those contractors has become more common, right? And so then the question is, what sorts of screening processes do those organizations have? Where do those people go when they come home? You know, and I do think that the you know, majority of people who are in the military, who are in private military corporations, are not white supremacists out to kidnap governors, right? But the fact that there's enough of them for us to have the FBI announcing both of these plots within the past few days is quite concerning.
No. You don't need it to be the majority. It's a critical mass. I mean, let's remember that one of the things that we know about the two Marines and the other guy who also was arrested is that what were they brought in for? To train, to teach. So they were being brought in because of their level of expertise. You don't need 12 teachers. You just need one teacher in a class of 20. Let me remind everyone. So people are counting noses going, oh, it's not the majority. No, it is their expertise that is seductive to these groups and being brought into these groups. And I also want to remind everyone that we see this at the highest levels of government. Who is Betsy DeVos's brother? Betsy DeVos's brother is Prince. Eric Prince, isn't that his name? And what do we know about him? We know about him and these private contractors. We know about him and that relationship. So, you know, you don't have to go very far. You don't have to dig very deep. They're right in front of you. Jen, you are wonderful. I have a funny feeling, unfortunately, I'm going to have to call you a lot because this is a frightening conversation, but it's a conversation that we need to be informed about. You can't fight something you don't know. You can't fight something when you don't know where it exists. See, that's the power of your piece at theconversation.com is that most people had no idea about white supremacy in the US military. We're supposed to revere the uniform. We're supposed to honor the uniform. But how do you honor someone who basically wants to undermine the stability of your country, and yet they're wearing the uniform of someone who's supposed to be on paper protecting the country? You know, and that's not good for the US military in the long run, because I don't want to look at them suspect. I want to make sure that they're on the same page with me, and that is they want to protect the integrity of the United States and not ultimately undermine that integrity. So Jennifer, again, I'm going to remind everyone, the title of her piece, we will post it on my Facebook page, Americans Aren't Worried About White Nationalism in the Military, because they don't know it's there. Jennifer Spindle is an associate professor of political science, and lucky us, at the University of New Hampshire. So she's just down the road a piece. It is a pleasure to meet you, and I'm so glad UNH hired you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's a pleasure. This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We'll schmooze tomorrow. Ciao.